So I am here once again with the lovely Jennifer Weiner, most recently the author of Fly Away Home. Jen, how are you doing?
I'm fabulous. Good morning.
Good morning.
Uh-huh.
You're very, very tan.
Yes, I am.
I'm very, very pale.
I know. Together, we're like a normal person.
Yeah, we're sort of like, yeah.
If you mixed us, we'd
be perfect. It's a yin-yang kind of pigment thing. Anyway, I wanted to first of all start. You named the protagonist of this book Sylvie Surfer,
uh-huh.
And there isn't a single Norrin Rad joke in this book.
No one was supposed to know.
Yeah, yeah. But unless mm-hmm. Richard is uh-huh. sort of your kind of wry nod to Reed Richards or Richard Ryder. You also named the politician Richard Woodruff,
uh-huh.
which of course is the guy who they built the Bob's Big Boy statues for. And Diana has a friend, Lynette,
uh-huh.
Who, if you're a Desperate Housewives watcher, mm-hmm. There's certain similarities there.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask about the sort of pop cultural inspiration for these character names.
Well, I mean, I think that I'm always sort of... writers are parasites, you know,
yeah.
So you're sort of out there like the little pilot fish clinging to the shark's back and nibbling bits of things that float your way. So I think that Sylvia Surfer was definitely a little bit of that. And Woodruff, I think, like, there's a political reporter, isn't there, Bob Woodruff?
Yeah.
So I think that was somehow stuck in my head. But I wanted, like, a really solid, like, all-American name. Like, I think... one of the things this book is about, a little bit at least, is assimilation and the idea of moving from, like, culturally Jewish to, like, American.
Yeah.
And so I wanted the idea that Sylvie has lost a part of herself by going from being Sylvie Surfer
yeah.
to being Sylvie Surfer Woodruff and then just Sylvie Woodruff in sort of the Hillary, you know, Rodham Clinton, Hillary Clinton move.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that, like, any writer who's, like, whether it's your subconscious or whether you're doing it deliberately, like I did with Sylvie's name, that's very deliberate, although I think only three of my readers, like the Venn diagram of the overlap of people who, like, A, read my books and B, read comics.
Yeah.
I don't know, but
yeah,
we'll see.
Or who watch television. Fairview. Also the name of Desperate Housewives. I've seen a few episodes. Yes.
I didn't know
yeah,
that.
I
don't watch Desperate Housewives because
really?
I was, well, it came out when I was writing Goodnight Nobody, which
yeah.
was my sort of, like, suburban murder
yeah.
mystery, and I'm like, I can't because I can't have there be, like, confusion or overlap or, like, but Fairview, huh?
Yeah.
See,
it's the name of the universe.
Well, to me, it was Springsteen. You know, I hear she's got a house up in Fairview and a style she's trying to maintain, but okay.
Well, in light of the fact that you do, in fact, you are parasitical, I think, with television programs mm-hmm. and television watching and mm-hmm. references, as we've discussed, and
right.
I'm wondering if that poses a certain danger that this may get in the way of your observations about human behavior or your copious descriptions about the decor or what people are wearing and the like, whether there's some sort of, you know,
I don't think
Jekyll and Hyde thing.
Doesn't trip up Stephen King.
Yeah.
Like, I think that you can use it as signal, you can use it as symbol, you can use it to sort of, like, place a character in the world, which is what I do. I try to stay away from name brands. I do try to be a little bit careful about that, but I want my readers, and for women, clothes are a kind of shorthand, like what a woman wears and what she reads and what she watches. Like, you can know her, you know, like by my blog feed, you shall know me. Like, I think that's a way of, like, letting my readers know who these people are. But I hope it doesn't get too shorthandy.
Yeah.
I gotta watch that.
Well, I actually, this seems the ripe element to bring up something I've been wanting to bring up with you, and that
Lay
is,
on,
as a close reader,
uh-huh.
I feel compelled to point out the fact that you have a lot of natural light suffusing
uh-huh.
against the surface. Two specific points in Fly Away Home. I'm going to
uh-huh.
give you the rundown here.
Lay it on me.
The sunshine made rectangular patterns on the hardwood floor,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
the moon
mm-hmm.
spilling silver light through the window.
Right.
In Good and Bad, sun mm-hmm. was slanting through the windows, making bright stripes on the ivory-colored carpet.
Oh, my
in
God.
In Certain Girls, the moon hanging high in the sky, flooding the lawn with its
silvery light.
Light. In Best Friends Forever,
uh-huh.
the setting sun, the play of that strange fiery light on the water. So I must mm-hmm. ask, have mm-hmm. you noticed this? Has your editor noticed this? Have you struck certain bargains? The suffusing of the natural light upon
can
surface.
Can I get paid by somebody for this? Like, does the sun owe me money?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, I...
Not
I
yet,
think,
anyway.
Not yet, anyway. Gosh. That's really interesting, because, like, I can't even say that it means something. Like, with water, I can
yeah.
give you my whole spiel about what it means.
Well, not about meaning, but about just using the light going against the surface. I'm curious as a
light
reference point,
on
as a description
the surface.
Point. Yeah.
Well, I think it's something I notice. You know,
yeah.
I think that... Well, I know. I didn't get my first pair of glasses till I was 8,
yeah.
and I'm really, really nearsighted, like legally blind, kind of like Mr. Magoo-ish nearsighted. So I could see light, but not always sharp details.
Yeah.
So maybe that was just like one of, maybe I'm imprinted. It was the thing I could see as a kid.
Yeah.
I don't know,
but if you're the sun and the moon, the goddess here of the book, I'm wondering if you're trying to give your characters throwing a little bit of light upon
little,
them
little
so they
mythology.
Can get through the day. Yeah.
Right. Well, no, I mean, I wanted them to be, you know, I think anybody you're going to build a book around needs to be larger than life in a way. And I like that Diana is the daughter of the senator and his long-suffering wife. And Diana is this very sort of controlled woman who becomes undone by her own appetites. And I like the idea and she, of course, just wants to be smaller than life. But she has a boyfriend who talks about her as like the goddess Diana, who looks like she's going to go shoot something for dinner and then cook it.
Or to tie it in with the superhero theme, Wonder Woman.
Yes,
I should ask you about the Wonder Woman costume. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, thank God they put pants on her. Like, when you're Wonder Woman, like, you just don't want to be worried about whether your, like, bikini line is looking right. Like, I'm a big, big fan of the outfit change.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, like, I think it took a lot to get it there, because I know that Jodie Picoult, when she was doing the series that she did, she was just like, well, can we change the, you know, can we cover it? And they were like, no, we can't. So I'm glad that finally happened.
Yeah, but the only problem is that she now looks like some sort of Peter Murphy reject, too. This they could have done a little bit, a little bit more contemporary, I suppose.
It's tough, though. It's tough to be a superhero.
Yeah.
I mean, Mrs. Incredible did okay. Yeah. I thought that was sort of, and then Violet was cool. But it's tough, you know? It's a fine line, because you've got the fanboy base that is not going to settle for anything less than, you know, the sort of Jessica Rabbit proportions. I don't know, though. I do think it's an improvement.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, I've got this argument with a friend, and I figure I may as well drag you into this, too.
Please,
drag
me.
The idea of a superhero requiring some sort of really colorful theatrical presence so that everybody will know on the scene that is a superhero. I mean, this costume doesn't quite do it on that level. But you're going to have to, like, actually pick out Wonder Woman from a number of other people who are sort of like down on their luck.
I see. Okay,
that's
saying that the Lady Gaga look with no pants was actually it was better.
Well,
because it signaled who she was and what she could do.
Not necessarily better. And we could go into Marston and all that if you really wanted to. I mean, it came from rather sordid origins. I mean, just from a creative standpoint. But on the other hand, it did stand out.
Was it just that pants were hard to draw?
No.
Like, I was like artistic decisions that are like, well, I just can't draw fingers real well, so everybody's going to have their hands in their pockets. I don't know. But no, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying about the idea of sort of using clothes to announce yourself as sort of who you are and what you can do.
Theater, you know?
Theater, of course. But I mean, she's so beautiful. Like, isn't that its own announcement?
That is too. But you could have probably a collaboration of the two. I want to get back to your book. I'm sorry to have gone on that tangent.
No, don't worry. Please.
I am curious about the book containing many 11th-hour announcements of major political scandals. You've got Mark Sanford, June 2009, that broke. You've got a reference to Tiger Woods, December 2009, that broke. So I'm wondering how this came to be. Did you have placeholders for the latest adulterous affairs?
No, I mean, I was revising, right up until the springtime. And honestly, reality was a problem for me for this book, because, like, you're writing about a political scandal, and I wanted to do something that was so over the top and satirical that readers would instantly know they were in the realm of fiction. So initially I had the guy, like, meeting women. It wasn't just one woman, it was lots of women, and he was meeting them on like Craigslist, like the casual encounters section, like using a staffer's computer or something like that. You know, and then I was just like, well, maybe that's just too much. Like, nobody would ever be that stupid. And then the Sanford thing happened, and I was just like, okay, somebody would be that stupid. Somebody would be even more stupid. Like, it just felt like everything I did was getting instantly trumped by reality.
Yeah.
Especially the John Edwards stuff.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, where does it leave you as a fiction writer if you have a guy who's running for president, impregnating his mistress, who's on the campaign payroll, convincing another staffer to say that he's the baby daddy, getting Bunny Mellon to fund your safe house, and then filming a sex tape?
Yeah.
I'm like, there is nothing more to, I should lay down my pen. I can't do anything more here.
It's too bad you didn't have the Al Gore thing.
That
would have been great.
I'm going to talk about that at the reading tonight. See, my whole theory about that is just that when you book the 3-hour massage, nothing good will come of it. Like, you're just asking for trouble. Something is going to go wrong, because, like, 80 minutes is the longest massage I've ever seen offered at a professional establishment. Like 2 hours, okay, maybe, but like at 2.5 hours, like you're out of things to rub.
Yeah.
Like something's going down.
To go back to what you were alluding to about the creepy elements.
Yes.
I was struck by the fact that Jeff is essentially stalking Lizzie.
I know, right?
Yeah, I mean, and yet we kind of buy it because, well, he's a tour guide. He basically delivers these historical lectures to people. And I can actually kind of buy a guy being that socially aloof to do it. But on the other hand, it's interesting that Lizzie, who is being bombarded by all this media scrutiny, would say no problem to Jeff, who is essentially invading her privacy.
Exactly. Well, that was the thing with Lizzie. Like, she's 24, but she's basically, you know, she's been traumatized. Like, she's gone through something bad as a kid and is essentially frozen at the age where that happened. So she's kind of 12 in a way, and she doesn't know, like, her judgment's not the greatest. Her judgment's not the greatest in, like, a whole variety of ways. But I think that things that would raise a red flag for a quote-unquote normal woman in her 20s, like, for Lizzie, it's like, well, and she, you hear her sort of thinking, well, is this okay? I don't know if this is okay, and I have no one to ask.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is sort of the real tragedy of her life, is that she's sort of clawing her way into adulthood without any of the support that you get, because she's supposed to be grown up already.
But she's also embracing the creepiness, and in light of her past history, which we'll get into, and in light of what you just said about, like, having to play down the Craigslist anonymous computers, I'm wondering if you had to tone down the creep here.
I didn't know. Jeff was always a good guy. He was always a superhero a little bit, like when she talks about him sort of silhouetted by the window with his, like, Clark Kent jaw.
Yeah.
He was always supposed to be a good guy for her. And it's interesting, like, there is a fine line between the grand romantic gesture and stalking. And many a man has found himself on the wrong side of that line, I think. But Jeff, I wanted to keep on the okay side. Like, I think he knows that he's sort of stepping over the line a little bit when he, like, follows her home and leaves the note and everything. But, you know, and then tracks her down in Connecticut. Like, it is... You know, I think that you could look at it on the one hand and be like, stalker, but on the one hand you could say, sweet, devoted. So
willing to reverse directory.
Willing
look
to,
up.
Yeah, so exactly.
That's, well, romance these days.
Oh, who among us hasn't done that? Come on, hasn't, like, you know, it's so funny. I just had a friend who moved and, like, sent out announcements of, like, you know, here's my new address. So, of course, like, the first thing I do is, like, go, like, to Google Earth and look at the house and look at the real estate listings. I just, we're in a Google world.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to also ask, because the only other time you've dealt very heavily with adultery is in Little Earthquakes.
Right.
Which also, by the way, has similar character headings at the beginnings of each chapter.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I'm wondering why you wanted to re-explore adultery. Was this a way of, I suppose, reworking the theme or approaching it with greater wisdom? And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, how did you conclude that the Society Hill Sheraton was the preferred hotel of all Philadelphia adulterers east of Broad Street?
I've never been.
Well, and why didn't Diana and Doug go to, for example, west of Broad Street to throw people off?
I think they've got short lunch hours. Yeah. No, but I thought... God, I don't know. It's so funny because that's the hotel closest to my house, and I don't know if it's like some, like, hotbed of...
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's, you know, it's where I have my Nana stay when she comes for Thanksgiving.
Is she having an affair? I hope not.
Oh, my God. Well, she's single, so it's all
good.
Oh,
there we go. So it's all good. So she's the
outlived,
other guy is...
Yeah. Right. She's outlived her husband and many sets of friends.
Yeah.
It's so sad. She has to keep, like, making new friends because the old ones die. It's like every time I see her, she's introducing me to new people. But, okay, adultery. I guess I was interested... Well, there's two instances of adultery in this book. There's Richard, the cheating politician, and then there's Diana, who's cheating on her husband. And I wanted to talk about... Because I don't think there's sort of like a one-size-fits-all definition as to why people cheat. Like, I think Richard... You know, I think that Lizzie's explanation for why he's done what he's done is probably as close to the truth as I could imagine it. Like, here's a guy, powerful, with just tons of access and temptation. And I think that sort of you walk a guy through the candy store 100 times and he doesn't sample. And maybe the 101st time he's going to say, you know what, I deserve it. It's been a rough week. It's been a rough month. It was, you know, getting that bill through was a headache. And, you know, I think that what I've seen of male behavior sort of in my personal life and then just sort of reading you know, like this, God help me, but this like Christina Milian thing and her husband, The Dream.
Yeah.
And he's off in the Caribbean, like with his assistant on his lap. Like, I think that for men, or maybe for a certain kind of man, and politicians are definitely that kind of man. Like, if there's
power.
Opportunity, right, like power. And then I had somebody say to me, like, I was talking about the whole, like, why politicians cheat thing. And she was like, because they have such big, responsible jobs, that it's not enough for them to do the things that would sort of, like, satisfy a quote-unquote normal guy with a normal job. Like, it can't just be, like, role-playing with your wife, and it can't just be like a discreet affair. It has to be sort of the, I'm hiking the Appalachian Trail, honey.
Yeah.
Like, you have to sort of raise the stakes and amp up the risk, because that's what's erotic to them at that point. Like, they need to sort of raise it to that level. It can't just be like, I'm meeting a girl in a hotel. It has to be like, I'm flying to Argentina, but no one can know. And then with Diana, you know, I think with Richard, it's opportunity. And with Diana, she is genuinely unhappy. She married the wrong guy.
Yeah.
And knows that she married the wrong guy, but is so committed to maintaining the facade of perfection and of living up to her father's ideals. Like, she wants to be the daughter that he's proud of. She is acutely aware that Lizzie's a fuck up, that, you know, Lizzie is not a daughter who can be brought on stage and paraded at rallies and spoken of in interviews. So she wants, you know, her dad was always leaving, and she wants to be such an exemplary child that he'll stay.
Yeah.
And so she's stuck. And I think she cheats because she's desperate, and she's desperately unhappy.
Yeah.
So.
And yet, to some degree, she's echoing the problems with her mother.
Yeah.
She also, what's interesting in this book is that weight actually works in the reverse this time.
Yes.
I mean, in the sense
yes.
that you've got Sylvie learning to cook and unapologetically eating.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Diana, who is running like the devil.
And hates fat people.
Yes. And just becomes this sort of, like, you know, having a rib stick out, you describe,
right,
and
right,
this
right.
sort of thing.
Right.
And even doesn't eat during her lunch hour. She
right.
swaps a meal for these dalliances.
Right.
And the like.
I mean, it's, you know, I think that I wanted to say something about the way that your appetites can own you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, if you... Margaret Cho once talked about, like, weight loss. Like, this was during the American Girl days,
yeah.
when she'd been cast in this ABC sitcom, and they told her she had to lose 20 pounds to play the part of herself. And she talked about, like, for her, keeping the weight off was like trying to keep a basketball underwater. Like, you can do it, but it takes, like, all your effort. And I think that for Sylvie, keeping her weight down, looking the part, sort of reining in the truth of who she is, was like keeping the basketball underwater. And when Richard breaks faith with her, she's just like, screw it, you know, and the basketball comes flying up. And with Diana, I think, again, like, she's got such a tight grip on her appetites that she's not even willing to recognize them. Like, she's all about control and rules and list making and benchmarks. And then she meets this guy and is just undone. And then when that ends, it's like she doesn't know how to feed herself, like, in very literal ways. Like, she doesn't know how to care for herself in a way that's, like, healthy and kind and is going to make her feel good. And so that's what she has to learn, is sort of to make peace with her appetites in ways that let them not own her.
Yeah. But what's also interesting is that I also want to remark upon the whole cemetery thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this seemed very interesting that you would choose this as the most perverse thing she was interested in. Was it at the time the most perverse thing you could think of? I don't have any real direct experience in terms of cemeteries.
No.
Other things, which I won't talk about, but maybe off the record. But anyway, the whole cemetery thing, I mean, it's interesting. She's a doctor, and
right.
here she is attracted
death.
To
death and
getting
sex.
Her rocks off on the dead here.
Death and sex. Well, no, I think that there's... you know, those two have been inextricably linked throughout literature.
Yeah.
And I think that the whole thing feels so perverted to her. Like, initially I had Doug being much younger, like a much younger guy.
Really? Like underage?
Not underage, but close. Like, just totally, you know, because, and I think, like, in talking to my editor and my first readers, it was like, it became more interesting to have him be a real possibility. Like, there was a chance, like, she could leave her husband and he would step up to the plate and become a stepfather. And that made it more interesting on the one hand. But, like, when he was 19, it was just, like, off the rails sex
yeah.
stuff. And so I think that maybe the cemetery scene was a little bit of a relic from that.
Was he a Peter Murphy fan in the initial draft?
I don't remember. But no, I think, you know, it's funny. Like, everybody wants to talk about the sex scenes in this
book. Of course.
I didn't think I realized they were, like, so, like, raunchy.
They weren't that raunchy. I'm just wondering if that was the most perverse you can actually get with this.
Oh, no. Yeah. I could have done much worse. But, I guess I wanted because the sex with her husband's so terrible.
Yeah.
You know, like, she talks about it as like, you know, feeling after they've made love like she's had some minor dental procedure. Like, you know, things have been stretched that don't normally stretch. And she's a little uncomfortable, but it's nothing a couple Advil won't handle.
Yeah.
So I wanted her to have, like, a much richer life with Doug. You know, because I think that... And I like the way she thinks about passion is like it's the icing that goes over the badly baked cake and can fix things. And, you know, I think that she does have this idea with Doug that, like, because the sex is so good, maybe it can fix everything else that's gone on in the relationship. And, you know, the fact that it started as adultery, maybe it can fix that, too.
I'm wondering why Gary wasn't some Team Fortress 2 junkie or something. I mean, you have him into mashups,
right,
into YouTube videos,
right.
Number of other things, and I'm wondering why he just didn't be, I mean, typically a guy like that is going to really just get lost in World of Warcraft or something.
See, I think that he's a dilettante.
Yeah.
If he was lost in something, she might have respected it. She might have been like, okay, I'm devoted to my goals and my world, and you're devoted to World of Warcraft, and even though I think that's bullshit, like, at least you're passionate and good. At least you have mastery over something. But I think that he just sort of dabbles in stuff and isn't very good at any of it, and I think that, you know... That's hard for her. But yeah, he probably would have been a World of Warcraft guy, right? He would have had some, like, avatar, and
yeah,
would have been, like, 9 feet tall and, like, shot things out of its things that shoot.
But I would argue that mashups, by way of putting two opposing concepts together, is at least a start of trying to figure things out.
Except, though, it's you're working with somebody else's material. Like, she wouldn't respect that. She wouldn't respect the idea that, like, you've put these two things together that have no business being together because you didn't make either one of them. I think that's why he does mashups instead of, like, if he'd done his own music, maybe they would have been okay.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask about one thing that shares a very strange parallel to Jonathan Franzen's upcoming book, Freedom, and that is the hush-up of Lizzie's rape.
Yes.
And this is very interesting to me. It seems clear that you didn't read the Franzen and weren't aware of it until I mentioned it to you.
Right. No, Jonathan and I aren't hanging out. Sadly.
Unfortunately.
Sadly, yes.
But I also wanted to ask, while we were on the subject of parallels, whether it was, you know, just, I suppose, accidental subconscious parallels, or were you familiar with Zoe Heller's The Believers?
Of course, I've read The Believers.
Okay.
Yes.
And Sue Miller's The Senator's Wife.
Of course, I've read The Senator's Wife. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to write about a mother. And the other one is Ailette Waldman.
Yeah.
Sort of the, if it comes down to your husband and your kids, who do you choose? Yeah. And Ailette Waldman, of course, wrote that essay in the Sunday Style section that turned into the Oprah show, that turned into Bad Mother, about, I could live if one of my children were to die, but I couldn't live without Michael.
Yeah.
And which I think is perhaps one of the most incendiary things any woman has said in public in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Because you are not supposed to say that.
Yeah.
But I think that I wanted a character who felt that way. I wanted Sylvie, when she opens that door and sees her daughter, you know, sort of like red-faced and like there's snot on her cheeks and she's weeping. And I wanted her first emotion to be annoyance. I wanted her to be like, oh, Lizzie, what now? Because I wanted to write about a mom like that, where she's, and it's interesting because I have the conversation all the time with my friends about, like, Hillary and Bill, what is going on there? Is it an arrangement? Is she really gay? Is what's the story? And I think she's crazy in love with him.
Yeah.
Or at least was at some point. I think crazy in love, willing to indulge, cover up, work with, massage, help him get to where he needed to be because she is crazy in love. And I wanted Sylvie to be crazy in love with Richard to the point where she does something that she knows is wrong for the good of the big he.
Yeah.
And then how does that play out in her life? How does it play out in her daughter's life?
But it's also an extremely dark moment when we learn that it's essentially at the expense of this potential fundraising, which, yeah. again, exactly like the Francis book, which is really
so
creepy.
Weird.
Except you actually sympathize with these characters, and yeah. he played them for laughs. But I know. And but I wanted to ask about this because in Best Friends Forever, which we didn't talk about,
right.
we didn't meet for,
uh-huh.
there was also an extremely dark moment in that flashback
uh-huh.
where the kids are taken away.
Yes.
And it seems to me that you were really gravitating more towards this extremely dark expanse of human behavior, at least from my vantage point. And it seems that you really want to push further in this direction, and yet, to some degree, you're kind of, you almost stop short of like really pushing yourself fully into something so dark. And I know you got it in you, so I'm wondering why ride the comic tone out of obligation to your readers or what here?
Well, I think for me it always feels natural to sort of have both, to have the darkness and the comedy.
Yeah.
Like that's just how I am as a person. And I think that my own family history has kind of made me that way, where there's been like horrible things that have happened, but like me and my sister and my brothers always wind up like laughing about it because like what else can you do? But it's interesting that darkness, because I mean, it's a tough tension to maintain, and here's the thing. I don't think writers choose the kind of books they're going to write. I don't think writers choose the kind of tone they're going to take. I think that it's sort of like a blood type. Like, it's what you're born with. Like, Stephen King gave the example of, like, he and Louis L'Amour could be, like, sitting there looking at a pond. And Louis L'Amour would come up with this Western about, like, water rights in a town that was, you know, having a drought and what would happen. And Stephen King would write about something that comes slithering onto the banks and, you know, first takes the dogs and then takes the cattle and then takes the kids. Like, it's just the way you're wired. And I think that I'm wired for good or for ill. I mean, there was a lot of sad stuff in Good and Bed, too.
That's
you know?
True. But we're talking about rape. We're talking about neglect of children.
Yes.
And during those sections in both of these last two books,
mm-hmm.
it gets really, really serious.
Right.
And then we go back to the laughs. But I mean, I'm wondering why not go ahead and spread this further. It's not to say that you can't explore light and dark. You can do sort of a double plot thing, like Crimes and Misdemeanors or something. I don't know. But
well, and then when you turn the book over,
yes.
they go shoe shopping.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, who's doing that well? Like Zoe Heller, obviously.
Yeah.
Who else? Who do you like? Because Zoe Heller's funny,
I'll bring up Richard Russo does that quite very well, too.
My mother loves him.
I'm trying to go ahead. You and Russo
mm-hmm.
are actually on the same team here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole
mm-hmm.
description of the development of the grocery store?
Yes, yes.
I could just as well find that in a Richard Russo book
uh-huh.
as I could in a Jennifer Weiner book.
Uh-huh.
You know, he writes about this kind of stuff, too. You
right.
write about this kind of stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, what do we do to get some sort of diplomacy here? I mean, it's not
like
Russo's
him.
Fault that your mother was
oh
blabbing about him.
God.
Okay, it
well,
wasn't his
was,
fault.
Okay, let me set the scene for you. Okay, the year is 2001, and my first book is out, and I'm in a bookstore with my mother, and I'm like signing stock, as you do. And you know, my mother, who's like very friendly and chatty, and this woman comes up to her and is like, oh, you know, I need a great book for the summer, have you read anything? And my mom's like, I just read the best book. She's like, it was funny and it was sad and the characters felt so real. And I'm like, wait for it. And then my mom's like, it's called Empire Falls by Richard Russo. I'm like, Mom! I'm like, because do you think that Richard Russo's mom is like up in Maine, like, you know, pimping my books?
But your mother probably was pimping your book too.
Mm-mm.
No?
Mm-mm.
Not at all?
No, well, maybe a little bit.
Yeah,
but no.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But no,
well,
but I think the woman asked what she read that she loved, and I think that she'd read Good in Bed like in Galley like months ago. So like, but no, I love Richard Russo. But I don't know.
Wait, you have read him then?
Of course.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Oh, so this
I'm
is...
I'm not a Philistine here.
So what's the issue here? I mean, it can't just be your mom. There's something else going on.
No,
here.
No, I like Richard Russo. Have okay. I talked smack about him?
Yeah, you've been sort of suggesting like, oh, Richard Russo, or I don't talk about him because of this whole mother
well,
thing.
Well, no, it's a joke.
Okay,
I like
okay,
him.
Okay.
I don't like Jonathan Franzen.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think Jonathan Franzen likes anybody, though, so I think it's all good. Like, I don't think he wants me. I don't know. Does he want to be liked? Did you read the essay that his girlfriend wrote? It was in
yes.
like the, where was it?
Catherine
Chattanooga.
It was in
yes.
Granta. Yeah, exactly.
Granta. Weird guy
yeah.
about birding.
Yeah, I know. But actually, since we're talking about the literary world,
yes.
I should also bring this up. Why give so much credence to the
uh-huh.
New York Times Book Review? I mean, this whole thing with the full-page advertisement.
I know.
And I read your Twitter feed, and I know mm-hmm. that you're there on a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock
uh-huh.
when they put up the new articles,
uh-huh.
and you were looking through those articles.
Right.
Why? Why give these folks credence?
Well, you know what it is? I mean, they're kind of the only game left in town. Like, they've, I mean, the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I used to work, once had a freestanding book section. And, you know, there used to be, like, I think the Hartford Courant, where I grew up, like, had a book section once upon a time. I mean, I think, but, like, honest to God, like, the truth is that my dad read The New Yorker and read The New York Times Book Review and sort of would get all of his reading suggestions from those two places. So, like, if you weren't in there, you didn't really matter. And I think that I internalized that to a very great extent. You know, but I honestly, I think that probably, like, the die was cast when I went with Atria instead of Simon & Schuster, like, way back in the day when I was choosing who was going to publish my first book. And it's like, well, Atria is much more commercial. And I knew that, like, I mean, I loved my editor. I love my editor still. I love my publisher. I knew they got the book, like, on a really visceral level. They were going to do a great job of promoting it. They were going to do a great job with me, but I wasn't going to get reviewed by the Times. And, like, but then again, if you call your book Good in Bed, like, are you ever going to get reviewed by the Times? I don't think
unless
so.
Unless you name it The Surrender, and it has a lot of ass-fucking.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it was like, you could see them, like, unzipping their pants as they were writing the review.
Oh, my God.
But here's the thing. Why should it even matter? They did a Jennifer Egan cover review, and in the first paragraph, not only did they diss people who live between, you know, in the so-called flyover states, a term I loathe.
I know.
But they also diss Lost fans. It's very clear that these are not our people.
They are
these
not
are not
our
your
people. And
so
I should just let it go.
Yeah.
I should let it go. Well, you know, I mean, I think part of it was my dad. Yeah. Part of it's my agent. My agent worked at Vintage, like, for Marty Asher. So for her, like, that's the holy grail. Like, getting them to review you is like, but then, like, I have to ask, like, does it move the needle? Like, when they go all out for Benjamin Kunkel, that they didn't make that book a bestseller. Like,
yeah.
I wonder how many copies of Jennifer Egan's book actually were bought by people who read that review and were like, I must have this book. Or with Mr. Peanut, which, like, well, that you can't really tell because that got great reviews everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, everybody reviewed that book. But you're right. I should that'll be my resolution. Now that I'm 40, I'm going to just let it go.
Yeah, but you can't. You're addicted.
Oh,
there's
I'll go to Promises in Malibu. They can help me with this.
Well, I mean, the question is, okay, I mean, yes, you're at the behest of publicity and marketing people and editors and agents who still view the New York Times Book Review as an influential outlet.
Not, interestingly, my publisher and my editor so much. My agent, very much. My publisher and editor, they gave up. They don't advertise there anymore.
Yeah.
They don't hope for it. They don't buy ads there. They don't think it does any good.
Yeah.
My agent still believes. She's the last of the true believers. They should hire her.
Then what matters ultimately? Blogs? Social networks?
Yeah. A lot more, don't you think?
Yeah, I think
like,
so.
I think that that's where the conversation's coming from these days, and it's much more bottom-up than top-down.
Yeah.
I think that if something catches on in Twitter, if I start reading about a book or linking to, you know, so-and-so's Twitter feed, or like Carolyn Parkhurst, I think, did something super smart with the, you know, the advice on how to do a book tour, you know, where she's like, you know, tell everyone who you are. They'll really be impressed. Like, she's doing this very tongue-in-cheek. Do you follow her on Twitter?
I don't. I should.
She's great.
I will do so after this conversation.
Right, because, like, I mean, on the one hand, she's got this book that sounds a little bit hard to get your head around. It's called The Nobody's Album, and it's this woman who's an author who's rewriting all her books because her son has been arrested and he's a rock singer, and it's like, it sounds like very sort of postmodern and tricky and hard, like difficult listening. But she's doing this hilarious thing on Twitter that I think has gotten a lot of, like, very commercial, more quote-unquote accessible writers really excited. So yeah, Twitter matters, and Facebook matters, and blogs matter, and God, what else matters? I think that being authentic, like, in the world of social media matters. At least for me.
Yeah.
Not for Jonathan Franzen. He doesn't have to be authentic at all. He doesn't have to be there. He doesn't have to do it.
Well, this is the anti-Franzen show.
Exactly.
But,
poor John.
But there's also not just the issue of being authentic. I mean, there's also the issue of, how do we take, you know, I take your work seriously.
Thank
I've
you.
Got the Bat Segundo show.
You do.
But I'm just one guy.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to think that there are other people who would, like, read all of your books and really see what's going on in there. They see that there's actually a lot of really persuasive human behavior and the like, that it isn't just pink covers. In fact, this one doesn't even have a pink cover.
No, it does not. I got away from that.
That
but it's still women from the back.
That
what
there's
can
stuff
I do?
That there's stuff going on. So, but the question is what more can we do to sort of, you know, get people to not be snobs about your work?
Well, I guess the question, the other part of that question is, does it really matter?
Yeah.
Like, if they're being read, you know, how twisted can I get my panties that they're not being read right? You know, that like they're not being taken seriously or they're not being read by critics. It's like, do I want to be the kind of writer who's read by critics and respected, but nobody's buying her books? Or do I want to be what I am now, which is sort of, you know, yeah, the critics probably think they're light and fluffy and dumb, but there's a lot of women on a lot of beaches and in a lot of airports and in a lot of hospital waiting rooms that are reading them and being engaged with the questions that I'm raising. I mean, I just got to let it go. It's my thing. It's not my reader's thing. It's not like, you know. And then there's the whole question of, like, do writers have any control over what happens once a book's out there in the world? And I think the answer is kind of no. Like, Philip Roth had the sort of, like, it's the suitcase that you pack and leave on the corner.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
You know?
But you have a new four-book contract going on.
Yes, I do.
So the question I have is whether this means, oh, hey, I can totally break out of the box a little bit, or I could actually try some new things. Is this in the cards? And then, all of a sudden, it does start to matter whether you're still treated needlessly, I think, as pedantic in some sense, or whether we're assessing how Jen is evolving in her work.
Well, that would be nice, you know. But then again, I mean, I don't know how often those conversations take place in the author's lifetime, unless you're like an Updike or somebody where it's like you've been a big deal from the beginning, and so people look at your body of work and sort of take like a, you know, a critical assessment of sort of where you started, where you're going, where you've been. I don't know. I don't know if that happens with popular fiction, but in terms of the four-book contract, like the book that I'm working on now is about surrogacy. So it's about four different women. There's an egg donor, there's a gestational surrogate, there's a woman who wants to have a baby but can't and so needs woman one and woman two. And then there's her stepdaughter, the daughter of this wealthy man she's married. And I think, again, that's dealing with some darker stuff and some class stuff, which is because that's the hot button-ness of surrogacy is sort of that it's rich women renting poor women's bodies.
Yeah.
And
purchasing. And an entitlement aspect, too.
Exactly. Yeah. There's entitlement, there's class, there's socioeconomics, there's geography, where sort of my rich woman lives in New York City, and the surrogate she hires is in Pennsylvania, and the egg donor's in New Jersey, and it's just this whole sort of, like, what does it mean to be located on the Upper East Side versus, you know, Narberth, Pennsylvania versus Princeton, New Jersey. But yeah, I mean, the other thing, in terms of darkness, is I've been playing around with this like science fictiony thing like forever.
I know.
This like dystopia.
I know.
Right.
I keep asking.
I know. But I think it's so dark that like I told my editor, I gave her like the elevator pitch, and she shuddered and was just
good.
Like, yeah, she's just like, we're not publishing that because but listen, it's basically It posits a world, again with the fertility stuff, I know it's like my thing, but a world where, because I have daughters, and like every mother, I am like obsessed with stories of like how young girls are when they hit puberty, because it's like dropping. Girls are like 10 and a half now,
yeah.
Which terrifies me. So it posits a world where like there's massive infertility among adult women, and the only people who can get pregnant are like 8-year-olds.
Yeah.
And so the state, sort of for the good of the state, rounds up all the 6 and 7 and 8-year-olds and takes them from their families and gives them to men.
Why can't we see this? If Steingart can get away with dystopia.
Right. Well, here's the thing, though. I think about alternative methods of publishing where it's like, what if I don't do it as a book? What if I do it electronically and like do a chapter every month?
Yeah.
Like sort of off the grid a little bit. Like my publisher wouldn't have to have a part of it, and I could like sell it for like $1 a piece or something like that. Like I'm very interested.
This is your plant.
Yes, my plant, exactly.
Yeah.
But he never finished the plant.
Well,
we don't know what happened.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, because like I think it's a way of sort of saying nicely to my publisher, this doesn't fit with the brand that you've built for me. I understand that, and I don't want to mess with that, and I don't want to take away from it, but I want to write this thing. And maybe I do it under a different name or do it under a different sort of method of distribution so it doesn't confuse people, because you don't want to confuse people.
Yeah.
But, you know, I look at Joyce Carol Oates, who does everything, you know, from sort of gothics to romance to, like, straight-up mysteries under a pseudonym, and I'm intrigued by that kind of career.
Yeah.
She also has no kids, though. Like, the no kids thing is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah.
Like, I read the Sam Tannenhaus piece about like how writers do their best work under 40. And I'm noticing that there's not like a single woman with kids referenced in that story, because yeah. I think that we're different. Like Shirley Jackson, I think, was sort of doing her best work like in her 50s, you know? Yeah. Like I think that there's something to be said for sort of the lessons that you learn as a mother, and then when the kids are in school or out of the house, the work you can do then that Sam Tannenhaus is not clued into
so
much.
And Lionel Shriver did her better work over the age of 42.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, no kids, but you know, I think that women maybe have different arcs of creativity than, you know, and he did mention Virginia Woolf, who's sort of older, but I just think...
Who committed suicide.
Well, yeah, let's not do that. It was so funny. My daughter was picking up stones on the beach and then was wading in the water. My mom's like, oh, no! I'm like, don't worry, she doesn't know yet.
But going back to this potential alternative publishing aspect, might this be the way to satisfy both your publisher and this
and
need of
myself.
Yours to... Because, say, your plant here is successful, then all of a sudden your publisher's going to go and say, oh, well, hey, this is raking in some cash. Maybe we can publish these books, too.
Well, that's sort of a backdoor way to do it. Yeah. That's like the end run.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean... Because I think that there are options now for writers. I think that J.A. Conrath has shown that. I think that anybody who's sort of like gone direct to Kindle with something that the mainstream publisher didn't want has shown that. For me, it's just going to be a question of sort of writing the book that I've promised them and then writing this other thing that's called The Motherland.
Yeah.
It's super duper dark. Like, it's like, it freaks me out in places. Like, it's sort of Margaret Atwood meets The Running Man.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
I totally want to read this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's sort of, it starts with a sentence where this woman is, every month, all of the adult women who've ever had babies have to go and have pregnancy tests to see if they've managed to conceive. And she talks about that she used to go with her best friend, Sinith, but ever since the BMI roundups of 2017, where they took all the fat people and, like, killed them, finally, a diet that works.
There is... lightness and darkness.
Well, that's the thing, right?
It's a dark humor.
It's super duper dark. Like the idea that they're going to like kill fat people for not losing weight. Like, but we're almost there already, aren't we? Like with The Biggest Loser. Like, you know that like 10 years from now, like they're not just going to vote them off. They're going to like hurt them somehow.
Shoot them against the wall. Yeah.
Yeah. Or at least like, you know, wire, you know, electrodes to their sensitive bits and just, you know. We're almost there.
Yeah.
Like, what is that show where it's like people getting whacked and then falling into the water? It's on ABC. I can't remember what... Wipeout.
We are so close. I mean, The Running Man was ripped off unintentionally but from Robert Sheckley's books, which also dealt with a game show where you would go around and you would hunt and be killed, that kind of thing.
It was kind of a riff on the most dangerous game.
Yes,
right.
But Robert Sheckley was like the middleman between... Most Dangerous Game and The Running Man.
Okay.
But anyway.
But we're almost there.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Seriously, like somebody's going to go pitch that to the network and they'll say, let's do it with convicts because they're going to die anyhow. Yeah. And somebody's
going to... Death row convicts.
Somebody is going to greenlight this. Yeah. Like, I believe this. God, I'm dark today.
No. I think actually...
What's going on?
It is possible to be a giddy optimist in a very dark world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do live in a world that... with this BP spill, with numerous other issues, that it's just...
And Mel Gibson.
I know. You heard that thing. I had to hear it twice because it was so remarkable. It was easily the most psychotic recording I think I've ever heard in all of celebrity history.
It's bad.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm taping the Joy Behar show later today, and that's one of the topics. And so, like, they do, like, the pre-interview where they're like, well, what do you think of this? And I think that I can talk about, like, you know, well, certainly through the years, there have been artists and poets and writers, and they've been anti-Semitic or they've been misogynistic or they've been jerks in their private lives and mistreated their wives and kids. But we can look at the work and we can sort of say, well, the work is the work. And, like, am I not going to read Ezra Pound because I know that he said this and this and this? But then I'm like, do we have tapes of Ezra Pound threatening to punch his baby mama in her implants? No, we don't. And, like, maybe if we had those tapes, like, we'd all be looking at Ezra a little differently.
It's also really weird that came right after the Polanski news, too.
Oh, my God.
I mean,
it's
like this somehow upstaged Polanski.
Well, Polanski, you know that he's, like, fist pumping in his chalet.
Yeah.
His hillside chalet.
You know, fist pumping seems a very good way to close this conversation.
Right, yes.
But you have to write this Motherland. I'm just going to say
okay,
that.
Okay,
I mean, really, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But it was
I'm
a pleasure chatting with you again.
Always. This is great. Thank you.
Thanks.
never a dishwasher that just won't start. Domestic bliss, are you taking?